Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 34, titled The Fast Path.
So Buddhism is like yama and niyama. Is that in the Shiva Samhita? It's in the Yoga Sutras, right? Yama and niyama are ethics. So before you can get it, you have to develop a certain ethic. And ethics are really, yama and niyama also mean restraint, self-restraint. So if you haven't gotten a little bit of a handle over your passions, and you try to do tantra, which involves dealing with the unconscious, because your body and your mental unconscious are interconnected. And so you have to have developed some degree of restraint of the passions. So that's the first prerequisite. That's one reason why it's esoteric, because otherwise people who have no restraint, or they're just complete, if they have a passionate impulse or a fierce impulse, they just have to act on it. If they try to do tantra, they will go crazy, hurt themselves, hurt others, it won't work out. You know, they will become, in Freudian terms, they'll become a victim of the eros and the thanatos that's in them, in their mind. Which is released naturally in yoga, I think, by the physical thing, actually. I think it is naturally released. That's why maybe some people have some, go through crises when they become great yogis, I believe, without necessarily thinking about it conceptually. So that's the first thing. Then the second thing is love and compassion. John did the give and take meditation that relates to the idea that the thing in life, the purpose of life, is love and compassion. That is the heart of Buddhism. Yeah, I think it's the heart of India, actually. It's why we all love India. It's why India has such beautiful music, beautiful food. And until 1,000 years ago, actually, females were powerful in India. They were. Like America's coming back to that. But they were in India until the Muslims showed up. I think they were quite powerful. And there were, you know, a lot of goddesses, you know. Where's the goddess in Arkansas? In Western religion, where's the goddess? Well, you know where she is? She's a ghost. What do you think the Holy Ghost is? The Shekhinah. That's what's left of the goddess. The great goddess of the Mediterranean, the great goddess of the Middle East, of Egypt, of Babylon. It's a Holy Ghost now. At least she's holy, but they don't say she. Father, son, and then they did without a consort. What?
She's disembodied. Is
she got disembodied, and that's why God got grumpy in the West. Tends to be cranky. No Shakti. So he rumbles and makes thunder and floods the planet and gets all pissed off. That's why, never mind. So that love and compassion is really the thing. You know, Maitri, you know? You know, in the Yoga Sutras you have Maitri, you know, Karuna, Mudita, Upeksha, right? The four immeasurable, four boundless states, which is also canonical in Buddhism. And actually that's not just an enhanced sort of meditative state, that's the heart of everything. The wisdom, the freedom, the citta vritti nirodha, all of that is not just meant so you can escape the universe, although I think many male Brahmins and many male Buddhist monks thought so. They thought if they could, citta vritti nirodha to them meant getting out of washing the dishes permanently. Because they didn't want to be involved in housework. They didn't want to have to deal with the relativity, you know, and to leave that to the ladies. Attain a soul male nirvana. But anyway, it's still the heart of everything. So you have to have that, because you get into tantra, you get into the power of your body, you get into the power of your subtle mind, of your unconscious. And if you don't have this, cultivate this open boundlessness, this feeling of concern for the feeling of the other, this willingness to be the other, to feel the feelings of the other, to be empathetic, to be connected to the other, then you might go nuts again and become a source, evil sorcerer, something like that. That happens, I think. It's happened a lot. So those two things. Then the third thing is wisdom, jnana. And you have to have jnana to a degree where you don't think, in Hindu terms you would say, you don't think that your little atma is the big atma, the paramatma. You know, neti, neti, you know, not, neti, neti means, not, it's not the neti part. It means na-iti, na-iti, na-iti. Na means no, no, no. And no means that, you know, your body is not yourself, your personality is not yourself, your this and that is not yourself. And the Supreme Self is like vast and infinite, one with God, one with all the beings. And so you can't get there without giving up those little selves. And then the Buddhists call that Supreme Thing selflessness, by which they mean the lack of that little self, that illusory little self that you think is really you, the real you, doesn't exist. The unreal you does exist, unfortunately. Constantly. It's just a little unreal. If you know that it's unreal, then you're more relaxed when other people don't take it as seriously as you do. If you think it's real, that's why you're so nervous, because then nobody else thinks your self is real. They think their self is real. So that's why we're always a little bit in each other's face. Right? So those three things, you don't have to know that totally and be already enlightened to do the esoteric, but you have to know that somewhat. And why is that? Because Tantra, this chakra business, Shiva Samhita, okay, in Tantra, Shaiva Tantra, like in Buddhist Tantra, you are Shiva, you are Shakti, you meditate like that. Because your unreal self, you say, well, okay, I can imagine myself being Shiva. Shiva gives permission to do that. I can imagine myself being Buddha. Because actually, any way I imagine myself is a little unreal. Even feeling like I'm Buddha or I'm Shiva, that's unreal. Shiva sometimes thinks he's really real, by the way. I don't know how much you know. Does anybody here know classical Sanskrit poetry about Shiva? I'm telling you, it's very funny. Why? The great poem is by Kalidasa, about the marriage, the love and the marriage and the courtship of Shiva and Uma. Or rather, Uma, who is the reincarnation of Parvati, right? You all know about her, right? She is a babe. And as Parvati, she died in a terrible, ugly way. You know the story? The reason she died in an ugly way is because her father, who was the king of the gods, Himavan, like Brahma sort of type, he thought Shiva was too dirty and too funky. He was a funky yogi. He was all smeared in ashes. He had a snake in his hair. He had dreadlocks. You know, and he was like, he was really funked out, you know. Ganja, he had the ganas, you know. He had this, like, elephant head. No, he didn't have the elephant head kid yet, but he was funky. So they had a big sacrifice, the gods did, and they didn't invite Parvati's husband, Shiva. So she was really upset. So out of loyalty to him, she jumped into the barbecue pit herself and died there. Her body was consumed in the fire, sort of. Shiva realized this with his psychic power, charged over there, ripped the corpse out of the charred corpse out of the fire, and started doing the dandava, the dance of destruction, holding it aloft in mourning and agony, her body. And he was going to destroy the world, because that's when he was thinking he was absolute. He was a real Shiva. He didn't think he was an unreal Shiva. He was a real Shiva. And because he was, you know, the emotion took a hold of that sense of his own absoluteness, which gods might tend to normally feel a little bit, their absolute. Some particular form of them, which is their mistake, actually, from the deeper view. And the gods didn't know what to do, so they called Vishnu. Vishnu said, I can't stop him. There's nothing I can do. So, but maybe he'll calm down if he doesn't have the body anymore. So Vishnu took his discus, and he flung that discus. And bit by bit, he chopped her body to bits. And these bits fell in 24 pieces, some say 32 pieces, others say. All up and down Himalayas, all over India, down in the Vindhya, South India, Tibet, all over there. And everywhere a piece of her body fell became a holy place for the tantric yogis, right? The pitas, the kshetras, they have all different words for that. The upapitas, the pitas, right?
Shmashanas.
Shmashanas, right. And then he did sort of calm down, but not really. And then he went and he meditated his anger and his rage at the loss of his beloved by the idiocy of the other gods. And the tapas, you know, the heat, the yogic heat was building up so intensely that the world was going to go, the galaxy, the universe was going to go supernova. So then Parvati, of course, being a goddess, reincarnated in the same parents. Her mother's name was Mena. And the mother and the gods were like hurrying up the gestation and the growth, and they're giving them growth hormones or something. Genetic engineering. The divine super duper. And then when she was born, her mother called her Uma. And Uma means to suffer, and Ma means may she never suffer. Like she did in the last life. And of course, Mena was pissed off at her husband, who had insulted the husband of Uma and called that the Parvati and called that suffering. So then, the gods were all set, and she grew up, and she was the most beautiful, just like she always was. And they thought that they had a plan. And they were going to sneak up on Shiva, whose eyes were closed, meditating, you know, and the flames were roaring out of his third eye, you know, but he was like this. So they were going to sneak up on him, and then they were going to kind of distract him from his samadhi, and then with Kama, you know, Cupid, in Sanskrit lore, is not a little urchin, a little fat thing, you know. Cupid is like a pimp. He's bright red. He lives in a heaven of vicarious satisfaction. He has like a huge bunch of girls that he brings down against yogis to stop their tapas, you know. But he has a flower arrow where he shoots people and then they fall in love. So they brought Uma to put her in front of Shiva, who was not into the plan, really. She didn't think it would work, but she was going along with him. She was to be standing in front of him. And then he was to open his eyes, and of course he would instantly fall in love with her, and then he would stop this annoyed thing. You know, he would calm down, you know, and stop destroying the universe. So, but unfortunately Shiva knew what they were doing. So the minute... They, just before they would do that, he opens his third eye and he incinerates Cupid. That's why one of the names of Kama is Anangapati. And Anangapati means the Lord who has no body. And his wife, whose name is Rati, which means pleasure, you know, sexual pleasure, of course, she's his wife. She's very upset because he doesn't have a body anymore. So they gave up that one. So then Uma herself, Uma says, you guys are pathetic. You don't know my ex-former husband and now my soon-to-be husband. I'll straighten this out. So then she goes and she sits on a hill across from Shiva herself. And she does 20 times the asceticism he did. And it's the most beautiful poetry by Kalidasa about her. The highland of her, you know, the drops of sweat fell down her perfect profile, you know, fell on the highland of her perfect breasts. Went through the three creases at her navel, you know. And meanwhile, her skin is cracking, you know, and it's like a drought before the monsoon, you know, this beautiful skin and everything. I mean, it's awesome Sanskrit poetry. It's just unbelievable. And so she did that. And then, you know, now and then Shiva takes a break and is meditating, and then she pretended to be like a student. She went over there and she said, you know, I'm a yogi and I want to be, and he gets interested because she's doing such huge tapas, more than him. So who's this woman? Boy, she's cute, but now she looks all scruzzy and messed up like me. And then she goes over and says, oh, I really like Shiva. I want to study with him. You know, do you know where he is? And this kind of thing. And he says, well, maybe I do. And then it goes on. And eventually he falls head over heels and he cuts it out. And then they marry. And then they have this fantastic love poetry. And they go to every mountain everywhere where the old holy sites are. And then, so they have a whole tantric thing. And then Kumara is born, you know, that's why it's called Kumara Sambhava. The war god Kumara is born from their union, you know, and Ganesha and all the people. Anyway, that's, I got into it because, you know, because Shiva, the Shaiva Tantra is very interrelated with the Buddhist Tantra. But what I meant by it is, I got it from the absolute thing, then there's a poetry where Uma tames Shiva. It's like, you know, Ganesha is born because Shiva wasn't being cranky. They're making love and their kid jumps in bed with them. So he just goes whack like that and knocks his head off. And she almost kicks him out. Get out of here. You better fix up your son or you're not getting back in bed. And, okay, dear, you don't know if he finds the elephant head. It goes on and on. And there's a wonderful poem, my favorite, one of my favorite is where the snake, you know, Guha, I think it's Guha, the snake, the cosmic snake that's in his head, the serpent, I think his name is Guha. And one of his sons and Ganesha are chatting, and, you know, Shiva's snoring or something, and the snake is annoyed because he says, every time Shiva plays strip poker with Uma, he loses and he takes me off out of his hair. And he throws me down on the ground. The snake, you know, it's the cosmic world snake, you know, the Uruguru. But Shiva tosses him away because Uma's beating him in dice all the time. Strip dice they play. And then the sun is, and they're warming their hands at the fire that's coming out of Shiva's third eye while he's snoozing. Like some two bums over like this. It's like the domestication of Shiva. There's a whole, it goes on for centuries, and it's so cute, really. Finally, he's like, he quivers in terror if Uma gets a little annoyed, you know. She's like super powerful. And that's Tantra, you know, that's the Shakti. You know? The females, the guys just have to shape up. You know, Shakti is Shakti, that's all it is to. So, okay, so that's interesting. So then, once that is the case, now in the case of the Buddhas, before you would become a big mega yogi, you would therefore have this ethicality and you would have this compassion as your real drive, and you would take a bodhisattva vow, meaning you would vow that you're going to make all beings happy. You are not going to tolerate unhappy endings of the universe or of any beings or of evolution. You're going to see to it that all beings evolve to a state of perfect bliss and love and joy and fulfillment, and all their wishes will be fulfilled. And that's what bodhisattva vow is. And of course, it's an insane vow for a materialist, because how can you do that in one life? You can. But for a person who has the karmic theory of biology, they know that they're going to be alive forever. No one gets out of here by dying. You don't get away from your yoga mat or your guru by dying. You were born and you have to keep going. There's no way out. Nobody gets out of it. It's my slogan. When I do the Book of the Dead talk, that's my slogan. Nobody gets out of here a dead. And that's a fact. From the point of view of Buddhist biology. Maybe some other biologies, they think it's just some little, you're just running around carrying a gene somewhere, you know? The gene just tosses you aside and runs off. Later. That's a silly idea. Because it's a selfish gene. Nonsense. So anyway, you have to have that bodhisattva vow. And you have that wisdom to know that you are a relational being. You're an evolutionary being. And if you don't evolve positively, like a yogi, you don't yoke your understanding. You don't yoke your body and your life to your understanding. You don't unite your life to the nature of reality. You know, the different meanings of yoga. That you're going to deteriorate in your evolution, you're going to get worse. So you have those different things. Then you reach a point where you decide, well, I don't mind being here a million lives to save all my beloved beings from suffering. I don't mind, because I know I'm going to be here forever anyway. We're all here forever. We never leave the world. Nobody leaves it. That's an illusion. They say that Buddha leaves, but it's nonsense. Because you become infinite if you become enlightened. If you become Brahma. They say Brahma wakes up. You know, and then there's no, it's Maya's gone and then it's cool. That's another male chauvinist fantasy. Maya is Mrs., you know. Brahma's a boy, you know, he wakes up. Come on, he wakes up and then she says, wash the dishes. Nobody ever leaves. So Buddha is engaged with everybody else finding bliss. And Brahma too. Brahma is really nice. I really like Brahma. He's called Hiranyagarbha, the golden egg. He's a really beautiful guy. He begs Buddha, he asks Buddha, in the Buddhist literature anyway, He says, Buddha, please go tell those beings that I don't control everything in the universe. I didn't create every little thing. I'm not omnipotent. I'm very powerful. I'm a golden egg. But I can't help it. When horrible things happen to them, it's not my fault. Please tell them. Their karma. We're all working together. I'm doing my best. He's like you know, he's like Manjushri or something. So, with that, then the Bodhisattva decides, well, I want to do it much faster than 100 million lifetimes or a billion lifetimes, because I want to develop the bliss ability to help all beings be free of suffering much faster. Maybe they'll take more time, but I want to get to where I know I'm doing the optimal thing for them, which means I therefore will want to become a Buddha really quick. How do you get to be a Buddha really? How do you compress millions of lifetimes of evolutionary, positive, loving, self-sacrificing, generous, tolerant, patient, wise action into one life? You go into the subtle body realm. For example, you could have a dream tonight. In your dream, you could be in a terrible situation. Libya, Afghanistan, or some other mythical thing, you know, on another planet. And those beings would need someone to give themselves to those beings to turn the violence and the mutual egotism and the clashes of the beings around against each other. And in that dream, then you would say, okay, I'll be a bodhisattva. Take my life. And you would give your life in the dream. And then in the process of doing that, you would be a heroine or a hero. And you would go through the debt, but no, I don't want to give my life. I'm just dreaming, but you know, I want to keep my body, so I want to do my yoga tomorrow. I want to go to this. I got all things to do. But you decide, no, this is a really, I'm going to give my life. So you'd go through the process of detaching from your grasping at your own life. That sort of heroic thing. But then you wake up from the dream and you don't have to get reborn, find a new womb, find a new mom and dad, grow up, learn Sanskrit, find a guru and become a yogi and become a bodhisattva. And you could even have 10 dreams in one night or 100 dreams in one night, and you do great deeds of generosity, morality, tolerance, wisdom, creativity, concentration, samadhi, in the subtle plane, compressing the heroic deeds of many lifetimes into a few lifetimes. Do you follow me? So both Shaiva and Buddhist yoga, that's what those yogis are doing. They are getting to be Shiva or getting to be Buddha faster. But faster, you know, then I'm afraid modern people in Tantra, when they meet some Lama, they hear, oh, Tantra's the quick path. Oh good, I don't have to go get a PhD or I don't have to go on the year retreat. The weekend retreat will do. Or maybe the 7-day retreat with Buddha and the yogis. You know, quick means like that. But no, quick means as opposed to thousands of lifetimes. However, once you really enter it, which of course you can't do just knowing about it, but if you really had those practices, you really entered those practices, then they say 1, 3, 7, or 16 lifetimes if you really keep your practice pure. If you keep your vows and your determination as a yogi, tantric yogi, or yogini, you will attain in 1, 3, 7, or 16 lifetimes without fail. You will attain the supreme goal. You know, whatever, moksha, nirvana, whatever you want to call it, Buddhahood, Shivahood, Shaktihood. So that's, if people begin to feel that's sort of somewhat possible, they get very excited about it. And all of the business of mandalas, chakras, it's all connected to that. And therefore, I always like to say that I thought I invented the word, but it turns out I may not have. These great yogis are psychonauts, I like to call them. You know, in a materialist culture, we respect astronauts, Because they sort of go beyond the limits of things, you know, out into outer space, you know, and they could be blown up, the rocket could blow up, you know, or whatever, or they could run out of air, or whatever could happen. The aliens could get them. But they go, so we respect that adventure, you know. But in this culture, the Shaiva, the Buddhist yogis, they go into the inner world, beyond death, beyond rebirth. They learn to die and be reborn like 100 times a night, 1,000 times a day, in some inner subtle plane, working in the mandalic. They create a world that's safe, like a mandalic universe or world, wherein they can die and be reborn, go into that self-transcending process. They give up the old, meaning giving up the old structures, adapt to new structures, and so forth. They do that again and again and again to advance their thing. Okay? So that's my introduction.